used for 3 months? I wouldn't. On the file systems we use now, like NTFS, which is our latest file system, I have been using it personally on my machine since July, and I have never lost a file. I feel really good about telling people they can run on that. I could never tell people they could run on a file system that I haven't personally used for at least 3 months. Difficulty understanding and prioritizing features. As Microsoft products grew in size and in functional complexity, the number of features expanded dramatically. As a result, projects needed a way to assign priorities to features. One way to prioritize was to focus on features in the next product version that would minimize calls from customers, which cost Microsoft about $12 each on average. Program managers also looked at market research data. Mike Conti described how the Excel group dealt with the problem of determining what features users wanted most. There was a bewildering array of features. As the product grew and the industry matured, there were a couple of trends. First of all, you end up in this pointless features war, which is a lot like an arms race. You keep adding more and more 2% features that very few people are going to use. We really knew that wasn't the way that people were going to choose and use products. Nevertheless, it had always been the way of the industry because it used to be an important measure of what customers wanted. But that trend is changing. We have market research from 5 years ago. If you asked people what they wanted in a spreadsheet, they said power. Well, if you ask them today, power is like fourth or fifth most important. Most important is ease of use. As the bell curve spreads out, you have people who are less interested in features, who have less time to spend with spreadsheets, less emotional attachment. To them, it's like a fax. They just want it to work, and they don't want to learn it. Products were becoming much more capable, so we had to make them work better. Program managers used to think of products and organize the specification documents in terms of features that were independent, corresponding to how they would break up the developers. As the specification grew in length and complexity, this feature breakdown approach became a poor way to think of the product. It also became an increasingly difficult description of the product for program managers and marketing to evaluate. Conte recalled problems obtaining feedback from the marketing group on a detailed specification document. We used to print and catalog the spec in terms of functional areas of the product, so we'd have database features, compatibility features, and analysis features. We would have them all broken up, roughly according to how the developers were broken up. But it was very, very hard to evaluate. I would give the spec to marketing and say, "Please give me your feedback. Is this the right set of features to do?" And marketing would either read or not read it, because it was way too long. Or if they did read it, they would get lost in it, because it's a super technical thing. And if they did comment on it, they would say, "Well, we think this dialog box is laid out wrong. You should really have the checkboxes on the left," or something. It's not the feedback you want as a program manager. You want the marketing guys to come back and say, "Wait a minute, this product is not going to work for lawyers who are a key part of our marketing strategy," or "It's not going to work for small business." The high-level feedback you really would like to get from marketing is things like, "This is not going to satisfy our strategic direction." And it was very hard for them to do that, reading a granular document like the spec. It's a little like reading the ingredient list for an automobile and trying to figure out, "Is this thing a sports car or what?" The program managers also attempted to use large meetings of developers, testers, user education personnel, product support personnel, marketing personnel, and program managers to discuss the specification and evaluate feature trade-offs. Conte recalled the difficulties in clarifying issues and making decisions based on those large meetings. You have a big group now, and you can't just rally around a motley collection of 300 features. There has to be a vision for it, a strong theme that everyone can understand. The bigger the group got, the more features we had to debate, the more irrational the process got. So we'd get in a big room and yell about things. Whoever shouted the loudest about their particular feature would usually get it in. If the feature was some new 3D chart or some very cool thing, that would get in. and if it wasn't very cool but certainly was important, nobody would rally behind it. Printing is very, very important, but it's not very glamorous, so people wouldn't want to do it. And it was real easy for there to be snipers in the room. One smart person would say, "That's a stupid idea," and then everyone would lose interest in the idea. So it was working out not to be a process we felt very comfortable about for designing our future versions. So we decided, well, let's kind of invert the process a little bit. Let's not even think about features. Finally, program managers faced a challenge when they wanted to present the essence of a new product to Bill Gates. Conti noted that relying on a preliminary specification hundreds of pages long did not work. It was actually somewhat precipitated by a Bill G, Bill Gates, referred to by his email address, program review. It's the question of, here's this really smart, really busy guy. How are we going to communicate to him what we're doing in the next version of the product and why we're doing it? Is this a smart thing to do? We could give him the spec and argue about the features the way we usually do, but that isn't going to be very valuable. It was clear to us that we had a really lousy system for doing this sort of evaluation. All of these factors, large numbers of features, the need for feedback from other groups, especially marketing, on feature evaluation and prioritization, and the need to communicate the essence of a product to the group and to senior management, helped lead to the formulation of activity-based planning, as well as the other techniques discussed in the next principle. Principle: base feature selection and prioritization on user activities and data. In Microsoft's early years, as Mike Conti related, what features got into a product often depended on who shouted the loudest at design meetings. There were more ideas for potential features than projects could develop in time for the next release. The most difficult question thus became which features to leave out. Strong-willed developers or program managers often got features into a product that customers did not really need or could not figure out how to use properly. To solve these problems, Microsoft adopted the principle of basing feature selection and feature prioritization in the development schedule on a technique the company calls activity-based planning. Activity-based planning is similar in concept to activity-based costing in accounting. The latter tracks expenses by what companies do, such as the expenses a multifunctional team incurs in designing a new product, rather than by formal departments or traditional functions. Microsoft people appear to have named their planning technique independently of the cost accounting literature, although many other firms study users intensively in similar ways. With regard to the promotion of activity-based planning in Microsoft, Mike Conti is one of the three original proponents, in conjunction with Sam Hobson and Chris Graham. At the time the concept was suggested, Sam Hobson was an Excel product planning manager, and Chris Graham was the group program manager for Excel. Activity-based planning begins with a systematic study of user activities for actions like writing letters or doing a budget. It then evaluates features in terms of how well they support important or frequent user activities. The benefits are more rational discussions of feature trade-offs, better rankings of what customers want to do, more focused debates on whether a particular feature facilitates a particular task, more readable specifications, and better synchronization among marketing, user education, and product development. Activity-based planning for feature selection and prioritization. The key concept in activity-based planning is to analyze a product in terms of user activities, product features, and interrelationships between activities and features. Program managers and product planners break down the user tasks or scenarios that a product intends to support into approximately 20 activities. Then they try to map the activities and any sub-activities to current features in Microsoft's product, as well as to features in competitors' products. They also map activities to different customer profiles, for example, novices versus advanced users, or different market segments. The activity-based planning approach has helped program managers and developers focus their energies and creativity when specifying new versions of a product. In practice, projects such as Excel try not to add more than 4 major activities with each new product version. Most new features map directly to these activities. The Excel group even lists how many activities each feature supports as part of the specification document, a practice that enables the project to rank features in terms of their value to the user. Mike Conti outlined how the Excel group evaluates activities in order to focus the next product version on just a few features. The net of all this was, as a business unit, to agree on essentially what were the important activities for us to focus on for a future release. Let's pick 4. I thought 4 was a nice number, no more, and let's prioritize them. And that would be our focus for the next release of Excel. We still have these big meetings where we all get together and yell at each other, but now, instead of yelling about which feature we're going to do, we would be arguing about the activities. We'd say, I really think the most important activity is switching from 1, 2, 3, and here's my data, and here's the reason why I think it's strategically important. And somebody else would say, no, I think basic usage is more important, because more people use it, and we've got to focus on new users. The end of that process was that we had a ranked list of 4 activities that we wanted to focus on for the next version of Excel. Now we go back to that big list of features that we had, and we said, okay, we've got feature number 1. How does it support our activities? Well, let's see. It helps building templates. It helps scenarios. This guy gets a 2. Let's do feature number 2. It helps templates. It helps scenarios. It helps printing. This guy gets a 3. We were never as simplistic as this, but we did actually go through scoring each feature. One effect of this scoring is that it creates competition among program managers and developers to make their feature support as many activities as possible. This is good competition, good for users, and good for the productivity of the specification and development effort. Scoring also makes it possible to select what features to put in a product, what to leave out, or what to leave to a future version that might target a particular activity. Conti described how activity-based planning has encouraged projects to create more general-purpose features. It had a couple of interesting effects. First of all, people still had to think of features that they want in the product, so they would think, okay, I'll cheat, actually. If I change the feature by just 10%, it will support more activities, and then it'll get in the product. And that's exactly the kind of cheating you want people to do, because we do want features to be more general. We want them to support as many activities as possible. It also gave us a way to take a whole lot of good ideas and say no to them, which is actually one of the hardest things to do as a program manager. Gathering data for customer activities, not product features. With activity-based planning, the project planning phase focuses on activities first and features second. Rather than thinking about and picking favorite features and crafting a vision statement around them, program managers and marketing personnel make a list of what activities their customers are doing. Then they center the product vision statement on features that support those activities. Microsoft product managers and program managers started to research exactly how people used spreadsheets, for example, and specifically what activities they did with the spreadsheet to accomplish particular tasks. They noticed that lots of people used Excel to make budgets. These users also followed specific activities. They might first make a template, distribute it, and ask people to fill it in. Then they might run scenarios on the template and send the results to a boss for auditing and comments. Perhaps they would later do some sensitivity analysis and eventually consolidate the information and print it. People also tended to do budgets twice a year. In addition, it turned out that large and small companies both go through a roughly similar budgeting process. In small companies, however, one person often does the budget. In larger companies, people specialize in parts of the budgeting process. As Microsoft people probed just this one task, budgeting, they found about 20 basic customer activities. Furthermore, they noticed that the current version of the specification did not adequately cover several of these. They also found that many activities used in budgeting resembled other activities, such as writing expense reports or forecasting sales. As a result, they created a more fundamental activity called data roll-up. Another activity that people making budgets did was to switch from Lotus 1-2-3 to Excel, including moving files from Lotus, as well as simply switching programs. It turned out that 65% of Excel users had prior experience with Lotus 1-2-3, but Excel did not take this into account and make it easy for former Lotus users to make the transition. Chris Peters gave this account of how activity-based planning has helped teams focus their creativity. We have this technique called activity-based planning, and that basically involves going to people and the customers and doing research on exactly what they're doing. If you ask people what features they want and what improvements they want, you always get this filtered through what they think is possible. And if a company tries to invent features based on the customer, they always filter it through what they think the customer wants. I think it's easier for us to try to understand what steps the customer is doing than it is for them to understand what we can write or invent. So we went out and did stuff like in word processing, like how typographic errors are made, or how do people do mailing lists. It turns out that the way most companies do mailing lists is that they have this list with all their customers' names and addresses, and they put that in the copying machine and make labels, and they run the exact number. Well, if you just ask people what features they wanted in a word processor, you wouldn't get that answer. You often hear, "I want a drawing package." And so, what are you going to do with the drawing package? "I'm going to do an org chart." So only if you understood what kind of things they are making at some fine level, and if you break these down to the activities that make up the different tasks, and you create your features this way, you can see if you have all the sub-activities necessary to complete the actual activity. And also you can focus on creating things that have maximum utility. In other words, this feature is used by 7 different activities. It allows you to be just as creative as you were before, but in a fairly focused way, because you haven't abdicated creativity. You haven't said, "Tell me what feature you want." All you've done is fundamental research on what's really occurring. Focusing on activities promotes a holistic product approach. Use of activity-based planning started with the planning phase for Excel 4.0 in early 1991. Microsoft also used this on Excel 5.0 and has promoted the approach among other groups, particularly where activities affect or require features in other products. The Word and Mail groups, as well as some systems and languages groups, have all adopted some form of the methodology. Microsoft has not written down the methodology or tried to make it into a science, however, in order to allow the techniques to evolve more easily. As Conti observed, "It's certainly popping up all over. We were kind of intentional about not writing it down and making it very scientific, so that it sort of spreads through the company and evolves a little bit in the process. We thought if we got any more than 20 basic activities, you just can't keep track of them, and it becomes a mishmash. It's not a very scientific thing." Activity-based planning appears to have spread among groups because it helps project personnel think about the product in a more holistic way. This whole product viewpoint helps project members from different functions understand what a product does, as well as how corresponding features in other products might support activities that cut across or require different application products. Conti commented on these benefits of the technique. "One of the things we tried to do is evangelize the methodology to other groups. There were some selfish reasons for doing that. This was originally designed as something only to help us essentially spec the EXE, spec the actual code itself. But it turned out a lot of times you would look at one of these activities, like switching from 1-2-3, and say, 'Well, you know what? We need a marketing program to support this. We need a chapter in the documentation to support this.' And so it became something where suddenly we could now take a more holistic approach for building the product. We also would find that there are cross-application activities, like creating a compound document, where there's a feature, not a feature that we need in our product, but a feature that we need the Word guys to add in their product. Traditionally, these kinds of cross-application features would be relegated to some appendix and easy to cut. Marketing research to support activity-based planning. To support activity-based planning, product managers from marketing conduct some joint research with program managers and developers, such as direct studies of users. In general, however, product managers do most of the research. As Conti described, this research is now a year-round activity. Traditionally, product planning research was this really specialized thing that would happen only in this 5-week window, right before we froze the spec. So after we'd finish, let's say, Excel 4.0, the program managers would now want to do Excel 5.0. They would say, okay, we need all your product planning research, and we're going to freeze the spec in 8 weeks, so get it all into us. And the marketing guys would be totally busy launching this new version, and they would have no time. By the time they had time to think about it, it was too late, because we'd frozen our spec. Because the activities-based planning research is more generally applicable, it's actually something we do year-round. Activity-based planning has also led to a broadening of the type of marketing research Microsoft does to support product development. Initially, program managers placed no constraints on what kinds of research people should do to gather information on activities, although they did make suggestions. Conti has preferred quantitative research to qualitative research or very small sample studies because it is more difficult to extrapolate from the qualitative research. One good example of a large research project consisted of a market segmentation survey done through random digit telephone dialing to U.S. households. The marketing group used this survey to ask what activities people did with the product, and it realized that Excel needed a new activity for list management. See Chapter 6 for a fuller discussion of customer feedback and product improvement. Microsoft groups have since gone beyond any one type of research. Their studies now extend from visiting customers directly to asking customers to use instrumented versions of the product that record all of their keystrokes. Conti continued, "That research varies from customer visits to special research projects. We did do some longitudinal studies of users. We would visit them every 3 or 4 weeks and see how they were getting along with the documentation, how they were getting along with the product. We have one activity called basic usage, which is sort of a fake activity. It's selecting and scrolling and entering formulas, and stuff that people do all the time that isn't necessarily part of doing a budget or whatever. For that, we have a special version of Excel called the instrumented version, where it records every action the user does, and we can go back and analyze it." In general, activity-based planning has given the marketing group a mechanism for more clearly affecting the evolution of Microsoft products. As Conti concluded, "We, program management, find we get much better info from them, marketing, than we ever did in the past. Instead of getting a list of pet features that they would like for the launch demo, we now get real information. Well, this activity is not that important. Don't focus on it. This activity is very important to us. Focus on that activity." It's also allowed us to get much better info from some of the partners who don't have the resources of Microsoft's group for U.S. marketing, like Microsoft's international divisions. Contextual inquiry for studying group activities. Microsoft projects also use a technique called contextual inquiry to help understand the activities of users working in groups or teams, although activity-based planning can capture activities of either individuals or groups. Contextual inquiry evolved at the Digital Equipment Corporation during the late 1980s from techniques anthropological researchers used to study group and social dynamics. Office, Money, and Cairo have applied contextual inquiry to help refine existing specifications and features, as well as probe for new types of activities that these products should support. Contextual inquiry encompasses a whole series of disciplines, exercises, and attitudes, and it is much more involved than activity-based planning. The basic model is an immersion process. First, a project team chooses a focus, such as creating compound, text and graphics, documents with the Office product. Second, team members visit customer sites. These are not really interviews, but are more oriented toward simply observing the customers and their activities. As a third step, which occurs during and after the site visits, observers take extensive notes and draw diagrams and models that record activities in terms of physical environment, work context, activity flow, and dependencies. Finally, the team members conduct a data extraction session back at Microsoft, where a dozen or so members discuss the site visit. In the data extraction session, people use hundreds or thousands of labeled post-it notes to build an affinity diagram, which attempts to capture the activities they observed and their associations. A site visit usually lasts 2 to 3 hours, and the subsequent data extraction session, 2 to 3 hours. Projects conduct a series of site visits and extraction sessions over 3 to 4 weeks. Mike Conti summarized the process. It's almost like an outward-bound thing. They come to this consensus, but they are not exactly clear how they did it. The people who didn't go on CI, contextual inquiry, don't come to a consensus. Conti also noted other limitations to the technique. The problem is that CI doesn't really have an output. There's no quick one-page-of-what-we-learned outcome. It's very hard for other people to absorb, so it is an awkward thing to try to spread widely. Another problem is that contextual inquiry is very time-consuming and can require project representatives to attend a series of visits over a 3 to 4 week period. Some of the results are also ambiguous. For example, a contextual inquiry study for the office group led to the conceptual separation in the user interface among places for finding things, ways for opening things, and places for making new things. Conti pointed out that in the usability lab, however, users had trouble distinguishing between opening and finding objects. Principle: evolve a modular and horizontal design architecture, with the product structure mirrored in the project structure. A key concept in Microsoft product design is that the underlying structure of products, especially applications with rapid life cycles, should become flat or horizontal over time, rather than hierarchical or top-down. When they build the first version of a product, development groups use more of a top-down structure in order to define an initial skeleton for the product design. Over time, however, they move toward a flatter structure that allows projects to focus on feature competition. Projects need to add and delete features incrementally, change and evolve features over time, such as move from character-based to graphical user interfaces, and increase the consistency of how features appear and operate across products. As discussed further in Chapter 6, an increasing emphasis at Microsoft is to share features across different products. Sharing helps to harmonize the look and feel of different products. It also facilitates user tasks that require more than one application, reduces redundant writing of code, and cuts down the size of individual applications. As discussed in Chapter 2, Microsoft also structures projects in a way that mirrors the structure of the product. It organizes products by features and organizes projects by feature teams. This approach makes it easy for everyone to understand how teams relate to the overall product. Projects begin by defining an outline specification in terms of a prioritized list of relatively independent features to develop for the next version of the product. Office, for example, has features such as editing text, manipulating tables, and formatting data. These are not completely independent, because the edit text feature relies on the print feature to print and the file management feature to save text. These and other activities also utilize features that Word and Excel used to separate. Nevertheless, related groups of features are sufficiently distinct so that projects can develop them in separate feature teams. Program managers and developers divide a project into subsets of features for each feature team to produce during each of the 3 or 4 major internal project milestones. For Office, Microsoft also divides the project into Excel features, Word features, PowerPoint features, and features common to all these products, usually built by the Office development group. Chapter 5 analyzes the techniques that developers use to coordinate and evolve the product as a whole, such as daily builds and synchronizations. This feature-driven product organization and development approach allows Microsoft to increase product functionality incrementally simply by adding more developers to a project and creating a larger team. As Chris Peters observed, we had a very large development team on Excel 3.0. First of all, which may come as a surprise to a few people, is that it does work. You actually can write lots of features. Let's say we had approximately 30 people. Did we do 3 times as many features as 10 people? No. We probably got twice as many features as 10. The development costs on Excel are minuscule compared to the revenues which are generated by Excel. So the fact that we used 30 and got the work of 20, that we actually got twice as many features in it than we could have, is a huge competitive advantage over Lotus. Features and functions as building blocks. The features in Microsoft products are relatively independent units of functionality visible to end users. They are like building blocks, especially for applications products. Examples are printing, automatically selecting a column of numbers and adding them, or providing an interface to a particular vendor's hardware device. Features in systems products, such as Windows NT or Windows 95, are often less visible to the end user. Microsoft and other companies sometimes simply call these functions. Program managers take on a set of features or functions to manage from specifications through testing and documentation. They must coordinate with the developers, who are responsible for estimating schedules and refining the functionality of each feature. Developers also keep the program source code for a feature in one or a small number of files stored online on a development computer. The development or enhancement of most features requires only one developer, although some large features require a small team. This variation exists because the level of abstraction for a feature is subjective. Developers decide the appropriate level. An example of a feature for one person to work on is to add character styles to Word. In a recent product, some features were so large that individuals worked on them, one per feature, for an entire year, although this is unusual. Most features consume about 3 person weeks, that is, one person working for 3 weeks. The smallest features may take just 3 days or so. One very popular feature, the auto sum feature in Excel, took one person only 1 week to develop. Product architecture. A flexible internal skeleton for features. A product architecture is the skeleton that is internal to a product. It defines the major structural components and how they fit together. A product architecture and the components that fit into it provide the backbone for implementing the product features, that is, doing the detailed design and coding. The architecture for a product is generally not directly visible to an end user. Only the features that the architecture implements are visible. The product architecture is also the skeleton that determines the long-term structural integrity of a product. Any evolutionary change in a product's functionality should not cause the underlying product architecture to unravel. Microsoft groups intend their product architectures to be very flexible in order to facilitate the incremental addition, deletion, refinement, or integration of product features. Good product architectures reduce the amount of interdependencies among groups, including developers within and outside Microsoft. Bill Gates emphasized this in our interview. If there were 100 people involved in Windows NT development, then there were 10,000, because all those people outside the company who were writing NT software were working to the same type of architected interface that the guys who were writing utilities were, and the guys who were writing user interface applications running on top of the thing were. So there's a whole spectrum of how interdependent work is. Good architecture can reduce the amount of interdependency within even a development group here. Product architectural layers. We may also describe an architecture in terms of horizontal layers and interfaces between the layers. A layer provides a set of functions and capabilities to the next higher horizontal layer in the architecture. Software companies usually call the lowest layer the system kernel. The highest layer provides the functions and capabilities, the features, that end users see and use. Sometimes, functions and capabilities from layers below the highest layer are also visible to the end user. As a rough analogy, a layered architecture resembles an onion. An onion is made up of a central core, or kernel. It has many successive layers surrounding the core, but the consumer only sees the outermost layer. The creation or definition of clean abstract interfaces between layers of functionality helps insulate the product's functions from underlying details. These details include dependencies on particular hardware platforms, like the Macintosh or PCs running MS-DOS and Windows. The central defining concept in a software architecture is the definition of the interface between each of the layers. Chapter 3 referred to these as Application Programming Interfaces, APIs. An API defines the published entry points that a layer makes available for calling by parts of the product located in higher layers in the architecture. A layer of a product can consist of hundreds of subroutines or sets of instructions in computer code. Developers usually only make a few of them available for other parts of the program to utilize or call. Typically, when a project breaks a product up into pieces for different teams to implement, they agree to define what types of functions and capabilities each of them will provide to the others. Those definitions are usually in the form of APIs, which can be lists of procedure names, what parameters each accepts, and a brief description of what each does. Well-defined architectural layers and APIs greatly facilitate the flexible addition, deletion, and enhancement of product features. Excel's architecture uses a generic layer for portability. Each of the Excel architecture layers, for example, has an application programming interface that defines the functions and capabilities in that layer. The APIs for the top four layers are the same for the different versions of Excel that execute on different operating system platforms. The API for the lowest Excel layer will differ depending on the underlying platform, such as Macintosh, Windows, OS 2, or Windows NT. But Microsoft insulates the bulk of the Excel code from these differences because of a platform-independent API for the generic portability layer. The Excel product architecture illustrates the concept of horizontal product architecture layers. We list Excel's five architectural layers here, from highest to lowest. 1. Formulas and formula manipulation. 2. Format table. Well-defined ways to create a format or display of data. 3. Cell table. Well-defined ways to put data in cells, enumerate cells, and so on. 4. Generic portability layer, an Excel-specific miniature operating system, or kernel. 5. Operating system, such as Windows 3.1, Windows 95, Macintosh, or OS 2. Excel's generic portability layer is an important technical strategy for the product's architecture. This facilitates the usage of major portions of the application code on different hardware and operating system platforms. In a sense, the generic portability layer is like a miniature operating system that specifically serves as an interface between the Excel application features and basic operating system software, such as Windows or OS 2. As John Devon commented, "We write Excel to our generic layer, which is our version of an operating system. We've implemented it on Macintosh, Windows, OS 2, and now Windows NT as well, although that one's pretty darn easy. It's almost the Windows version, just compiled for Win32. It's a pretty straightforward virtualization of graphical environment concepts. We did Mac Excel 2.2 and OS 2 Excel 2.2 from that layer." Not every Microsoft application product has a generic portability layer like that in Excel. Word does not, for example. Word 6.0 used the Windows API to approximate a generic layer, although this first effort resulted in the noticeably poor performance of the initial Macintosh version. See Chapter 3. The Excel group wrote their generic layer relatively early in the development of the product in order to facilitate use of the same code on both Macintoshes and PCs. Devon summarized the developmental status of a generic portability layer for Word. Word, for example, is just working on getting there, having a generic layer, and they're going to use the Windows API as their layer. We, Excel, did ours a long time ago. It was actually an experiment because when we were thinking about it, there were definitely skeptics among us. Could you even make a decent program within performance constraints with this kind of approach? So we got to do the experiment on Excel. At that time, we thought there wasn't a way to make a good Macintosh program using the Windows API as that abstraction. And part of it is, we knew both APIs, having done Mac Excel 1.0 on the Mac API and Excel 2.0 on the Windows API. They're a lot similar, and they're a lot different. I think at times we were focusing a lot on the differences and saying, wow, these differences are not overcomable directly, so we don't think we could do that. But as you get more familiar with stuff, you get some different perceptions. Product architecture for Windows 95. As another example of a product architecture, Windows 95 uses specialized layers to support a wide range of applications, including 32-bit, 16-bit, and DOS applications. These layers, called virtual machines, provide separate processing threads and protected areas. Each looks like an individual computer to the programs running on top of it. All Windows applications, including the 16-bit Windows 3.1 applications and the 32-bit applications for Windows 95 or Windows NT, execute in the System Virtual Machine layer. Within the System Virtual Machine, each 32-bit application has its own private address space. A private address space prevents the application's data from interfering with another application's data or causing the other application to halt abnormally or crash. All 16-bit applications share a single common address space in the System Virtual Machine, so they may still interfere with one another, just like they do in Windows 3.1. The Windows subsystem supports the System Virtual Machine, and the Windows API defines the capabilities in the Windows subsystem. Each DOS application executes in its own DOS virtual machine and uses its own private address space. The Windows 95 base system provides the lowest layer in the product architecture, and the base system supports the System Virtual Machine, Windows subsystem, and DOS virtual machines. The base system includes a file management subsystem, disk files, CD-ROM files, and so forth, network subsystem, including remote computer access and data sharing protocols, operating system services, plug-and-play configuration capabilities, date-time functions, and the like, virtual machine manager subsystem, and device drivers, keyboard, display, mouse, and so on. The virtual machine manager subsystem in the base system constitutes the heart of the Windows 95 operating system. The virtual machine manager subsystem implements the basic system functions for process scheduling, memory operations, and program starting and termination. Product subsystems. A horizontal layer in a product architecture can have several distinct subsystems, or subsets of functions and capabilities. Each subsystem has an API that is a direct subset of the API for its architectural layer. For example, Windows 3.1 developed the concept of a universal print subsystem. This has a simple API and enables third-party vendors to write printer drivers in a much more straightforward way than in past Windows versions. Printer drivers are small vendor-specific programs that control the printing of a document or data on the vendor's printer. Brad Silverberg described the usefulness of the universal print subsystem approach and how Microsoft is applying the same concept to a universal video subsystem and elsewhere. With Windows 3.1, we went to a new printer driver architecture, which we called the Universal Driver. It's a powerful generic printer driver engine that allows them to use small snap-on modules, which we call mini-drivers. In the simple case, they, the persons writing the printer mini-driver, Basically, just describe a table of the escapes that are needed to talk to the printer. All the rasterization, such as computing line positioning, and all the device management is done in the piece, subsystem, that we supply. So that turned the act of writing a printer driver from having a very skilled person take 6 months to write a monolith to someone who could read a printer manual, look up a table of the escapes, and spend a 2 to 3 week effort. As a result, with Windows 3.1, we got great printer drivers and coverage for a lot more printers. The issue of printer drivers dying is no longer a problem. We got a lot of that information from PSS. And we're taking that same philosophy with most of our other drivers now. We didn't do the universal driver approach for video in Windows 3.1, so video drivers were a problem, and people had buggy video drivers that crashed the system. So for Chicago, Windows 95, we're going to a universal video driver architecture with small snap-on mini drivers for individual video cartridges. We're doing the same for universal modems drivers with small snap-on modems. We're doing the same for hard disk drives, and so on. Feature-driven versus performance-driven product architectures. Many existing Microsoft products, such as Office and Excel, embody a feature-driven product architecture. Such emerging products as the Video On Demand Tiger project or other multimedia projects, however, require performance-driven product architectures. The architectures differ because, for example, delivering video and audio requires consistent real-time system behavior under heavily loaded conditions. Real-time means that a product must perform some operation, such as delivering video or audio, almost instantaneously by a fixed deadline, or else the information is useless. According to Rick Rashid, Vice President for Research, these inflexible performance requirements do not fit into the traditional Microsoft notion of a product feature. There might be goals in products like Word and Excel to perform this operation within this amount of time, but they're not hard statements that it has to do precisely this. They're statements saying that it should do about this. When you think of delivering video, for example, over a cable TV network or a telephone or even in a standard computer network, you have very, very strong guarantees that have to be given as to when information arrives and how quickly it has to be processed to have it function correctly. And the behavior of the system under load has to be completely specified. It can't be the case that the system under load behaved dramatically differently from the system in lightly loaded situations. It has to be the case that the system under load behaves exactly according to its specification and refuses to accept additional load beyond a certain point so that it can maintain its guarantees. Microsoft's development process for building these types of performance-driven systems includes mathematical and algorithmic design for guaranteed behavior under all possible load situations. This development process emphasizes fault tolerance, which means that the system can recover automatically from failures during operation. For example, the Tiger video server project, discussed in Chapter 3, started out as a research activity, and it had an extensive upfront analysis and simulation phase. Now, it has moved into the Advanced Consumer Systems Division, with Rashid acting as the Director of Interactive TV and Video Systems Development. The project took about 6 months of work to define the basic system ideas and produce an initial working version. The research group also used processes such as frequent builds and milestones and allowed the specification to evolve, although they had to specify critical performance elements of the system before they began coding. This emphasis on performance first, rather than on features or functions, and the need for analysis and simulation up front, are probably the critical differences between these new types of systems versus the other kinds of products Microsoft usually builds. Rashid continued, "I think that's one area where the greatest difference may occur, whereas a more traditional path might be, for example, to first get functionality there and then deal with performance issues. When you have significant constraints, you have to first resolve those constraints algorithmically, by analysis and by modeling, and then you worry about what other features you may want to add on top of that, or what other things you wanted to do. I think the difference may be one of bringing up issues of performance and quality divisions in behavior early in the process rather than leaving them for later in the process, which is probably more traditional in any computer project. Little architectural documentation. Source code is the one document. True to the hacker tradition, other than the API documentation, Microsoft does not produce much written documentation on the architectural structure of its products. Sometimes senior developers write down the higher-level architecture, but this depends on the development manager. For complicated features, many individual developers write down and review the architectural details specific to their features at some point, but this is up to their discretion. A few groups have documentation for new programmers that lays out a level of structure beyond code files and features. For example, an 8-page document goes over Word's internal structure, major data structures, how they work, and so on. People do not update these regularly, however, and managers do not require projects to produce such internal documents. The specification, in turn, does not talk about implementation. Developers should know how to do the implementation or be able to learn it. Chris Peters explained that there is so little written architectural documentation because a developer's job is to write code that we sell, not to spend time writing high-level design documents. Bill Gates supported this view, emphasizing that design documents should not be separate from the source code. There is some methodology where you have a document that's independent from the source code. If you think that you're going to gain greater efficiency by going off and spending a lot of time on that other document, that's ridiculous. A lot of rules that are fairly rigid in nature are pretty ridiculous. So there are a lot of pragmatics that go into building great designs and building great software. One document. One. It's the source code. It's the one place you go. You learn everything there, and you know everything there. Compartmentalizing code and keeping it simple. Instead of relying on documentation of the product architecture, Microsoft depends on developers to compartmentalize code. This usually works, but not always. John Devine described the reliance on developers. We don't do, and we always get into discussions where this might be a liability, a lot of overall design stuff, like that feature should be grouped in this module and this should be the interface for that. We don't do that. We rely on people's judgment that they properly compartmentalize things. Sometimes people don't, and that can be a problem. Devine emphasized that Microsoft also tries to keep the design and code as simple as possible. The other kind of guiding principle we have is keep it simple. Things don't need to be complex unless they need to be complex. Surprisingly enough, and I'm not sure if it's the way computer science is taught or other things, people like to make things complex, even when they don't need to be. One example of compartmentalization and simplicity is a revert-to-save procedure that Devine worked on for Excel 5.0. The original procedure was very complicated, affecting as many as 20 different parts of the program. Since people did not commonly use the feature, developers would often forget it existed and break the feature when making an unrelated change. As a result, it has been historically riddled with bugs. Devine replaced this with a much simpler design that centralizes the function in one place in the code so that developers working on other parts of the system do not have to worry about it. Ben Slivka, development manager for MS-DOS 6.0, gave another example of poor compartmentalization and an overly complex design in a portion of his product. The split between the user interface of DoubleSpace Manager and the Compression Engine Library, CEL, was conceived to allow a Windows-based UI, user interface, to be written without requiring changes to the CEL. CEL would understand all the details of the CVF, compressed volume file, format, restartability, etc. Unfortunately, this concept was not carried out, and so major aspects of restartability, robustness, and CVF limits and properties are spread throughout both DoubleSpace Manager and CEL. In the future, We should make sure all team members have practice at object-oriented design, focusing on data hiding and minimal interfaces, to ensure that code will be modular, decoupled, and maintainable. A 2 to 4 week teaching period where a project is designed and implemented would be a very, very good thing. Growth in product size. Microsoft and other companies use product size metrics to make sure that developers are aware of how large their products are becoming from one version to the next. The continual addition of new features and graphical capabilities can cause substantial growth in the number of source lines of code in a product and in the size of its executable file. For example, the number of lines of source code in Mac Word increased 68% from version 3.01, 152,525 lines, to version 4.0, 256,378 lines. Other products whose size metrics indicate substantial growth include Word for Windows, 31% between versions 1.0 and 2.0, Excel, 31% between versions 3.0 and 4.0, Project for Windows, 85% between versions 1.0 and 3.0, and Windows NT, 109% between Preliminary Developer's Kit 2 and Beta 1. Additional features may justify the size increases. Developers and testers, however, pay the penalty of having to understand, modify, test, and debug ever larger amounts of code. As the code grows, developers generally try to compartmentalize features and localize the dependencies between them. Tracking these measures helps keep the length of time required to change, debug, and test features manageable. In some cases, project groups have to change their development style. For example, Office has adopted a 2-stage build process in order to accommodate its large volume of code and decrease the time spent in product builds. See Chapter 5. Developers should also try to keep down the amount of disk space that a product requires. This is the size of a product's executable file. It has ramifications for packaging the product on floppy disks, as well as for assessing aspects of the product's memory usage. A product's executable file size, however, is not easy to manage or predict. It depends on the amount of code and data specific to a product, as well as the amount of reusable or shared code included in or linked to one product from other products. For example, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint share some features as part of the Office suite. Office also links with some files directly from the Windows operating system. The individual executable sizes of the applications, if installed separately, are larger than if a user installs the three products as part of the Office suite running on Windows. For this and other reasons, there is no direct correspondence between lines of code and executable size. Another illustration is Word for Windows 1.0 and Project for Windows 3.0, which have similar numbers of source code lines, but dramatically different executable sizes. Microsoft projects use both actual numbers and graphs to keep track of executable size, and developers will spend some time trying to reduce these numbers by making the code more concise and efficient. The large jump from May to July of 1991 and the subsequent decrease from August to October of the same year reflect the addition and deletion of features, the enabling and disabling of debugging code, code optimizations, and other factors. Feature teams and content experts as team leaders. In Chapter 2, we described feature teams as small groups of usually 3 to 8 developers who work on related areas of features under the direction of a feature team lead. Team size often depends on how experienced or capable the team lead is. More experienced leads take on larger teams. Feature team leads report to the project's development lead, who has a broad view of the product and can best see interconnected problems. He or she is in charge of all the development work for the project. John Devon felt that the feature team leads are key to Microsoft's development process and ability to integrate new people. Feature team leads are very important, I think that they're the most important thing in making the whole process work, because when push comes to shove and people need guidance, they're the ones who have the job title and responsibility to give it. They're also responsible for writing a lot of code as well. Several groups moved toward feature teams at about the same time during the late 1980s. Excel was one of the leaders, adopting the feature team concept while building version 3.0 during 1989 and 1990. The group had only a few teams at this time, although the number has increased significantly since then. For example, Excel 5.0, shipped in late 1993, had 10 feature teams. 8 worked on the basic Excel product, 1 worked on a separate graph product, and another worked on the query tool product. In comparison, Word 6.0, shipped in early 1994, had 6 feature teams. The Windows 95 project also centers around feature teams. Because of its size, more than 100 developers, managers initially grouped the feature teams into 3 larger self-contained teams, one team for the Windows 95 base, one for networking, and one for mobile components. The project later consolidated networking and mobile. As Brad Silverberg explained, there are 2 feature teams under the mobile. Under networking, there are probably half a dozen. Under the base, there are probably 10. The base is the biggest group, and they have the most number of people by far, and really the most number of pieces of the product. They're building the file system, the shell, the underlying kernel, the device drivers, and so there are probably 10 to 12 different teams. Each has a feature team lead and program manager in charge of that area. And again, for each area, if the feature team lead is really strong, he drives that area forward. If the program manager is really strong, he drives that area forward. If they are both strong, they tend to drive it together. Silverberg considered the people in charge of the major self-contained teams for Windows 95 as content experts. Within my group, I break them down into 3 major teams. They are pretty well self-contained in that they have program management, development, and testing, all the development parts of the puzzle within the group. One for the base piece, one for the networking pieces, and one for the mobile pieces, because that enables those teams to still be relatively small and keep the hierarchy flat. And the person in charge of that piece will be a content expert. If you look at successful software products, the ones I've been associated with at Borland or here at Microsoft, people in decision-making positions, program managers, testers, developers, marketing guys, are also content experts. They know that product. They know how to use the product. They know the competitor's product. They know where the future is going. They know technology. They are product people. They're not just the managers. They are content experts. And when you know the products, you can make the right decisions. When you don't, when you're just trying to build off some product spec, you just lose track of what's important. There's no sense of priorities or sense of what's really important or exciting, what's important to really do right. Silverberg also stressed the need to keep feature teams small with close working relationships because products tend to resemble the organizations that create them. The software tends to mirror the structure of the organization that built it. If you have a big, slow organization, you tend to build big, slow software. If you have a small and nimble group that talks together well, then the pieces that they write tend to work together very well. If you have 2 teams that have to deliver tightly coupled software, but the 2 teams don't get along together well, what you end up with, usually, are very formal interfaces between the 2 groups and between the 2 components. So I can often look at a piece of software and tell you about the company that built it, and with pretty good accuracy. You put 15 people on a compiler, you tend to end up with a 15-pass compiler, and 15-pass compilers tend to be pretty slow. Everyone is an expert for some functional area. Many Microsoft products are now so large that managers encourage developers to become experts in parts of the code. As a result, developers often consult with other developers, the local experts, to make coding or architectural decisions that might affect other features. Windows NT, for example, has hundreds of functional areas where some individual has become the expert. Products such as Excel and Word are smaller, but they also have dozens of functional areas and experts for each area. Lou Parazzoli commented on this. One of the things we do is try to make sure that everybody has an area of expertise. I think that does two things. One, it gives you some place to go when you have a problem. You can go to a person who is the expert in that area. And two, it lets people feel really good about themselves because they are the expert in this area. And we don't encourage people to be experts only in one area. As in all software companies, some developers are far more skilled and experienced than others. Microsoft projects take advantage of these differences by assigning the most difficult tasks and areas to the most capable people. Usually, only the more experienced or talented developers make changes that affect many parts of the product simultaneously, such as altering the kernel code in NT or the recalc engine in Excel. Chris Peters observed, "The old model that some developers are 10 times better than the others is true, no matter at what level of development you are. There's always a guy that's 10 times better than you. If you're this hot dog guy, you would get huge responsibilities. It's almost assigned based on how many tentacles that the actual feature has. If it's a fairly small, self-contained feature, we will tend to give it to a very junior person. And if it has all sorts of side effects and ramifications, it tends to be given to a more senior person." The next principle describes how the feature-based product organization and feature team project structure also form the basis for project scheduling. Principle: control by individual commitments to small tasks and fixed project resources. Estimation for product development and delivery schedules is a very challenging task, especially in software projects. There are many factors that affect the schedule, and development progress is difficult to measure. Microsoft managers deal with these difficulties by pushing responsibility for schedules and work management down to the lowest level, the individual developers and testers. This ensures that everyone takes individual responsibility in addition to acting as part of a team. Individual developers set their own schedules, and program managers aggregate the individual schedules and add buffer time in order to formulate an overall project schedule. Top executives also fix the basic resources, people and calendar time, to make sure that projects focus and limit their effort and creativity. The key goal, particularly in applications, is to specify a target ship date for the product and try to stick to it as long as possible. Program managers and developers then work backwards from the ship date and define the dates for the intermediate project milestones. This fixed ship date approach centers on developers. The motivation is to reduce the number of situations where project